There's lots of these infrastructure projects go way over budget. And what we think, our view is that they all go over budget for one simple reason: poor planning.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 100, episode 100 of the Flux Capacitor. When I started this podcast 5 years ago, I promised discussions on the future of the business of electricity and the impacts of technological change and market transformation. I had planned on discussions with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future challenges will mean for electricity companies, for regulators, society, and for customers. I wanted you, the listener, to get a sense of the conversations that were already taking place on coffee breaks at industry conferences, on the margins of regulatory hearings, or over drinks following a parliamentary committee appearance. So here we are 100 episodes later, and I hope I've been delivering on that promise. For the 100th episode, my guest on the pod is...
Ken Hartwick, President and CEO of Ontario Power Generation.
I am delighted to welcome Ken back for a conversation on a rapidly changing world with electrification and population growth putting additional pressure on demand for electricity. We also talk about supply chain challenges, given that every other jurisdiction is also seeking to electrify and decarbonize at the same time. We talk about increasing public acceptance for nuclear power and the challenges generally of building large infrastructure projects. We touch on what generation technologies will be in Ontario's future, Indigenous partnerships, and attracting and retaining talent. We close the conversation with Ken's recommendation for a book to add to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with Ken Hartwick, recorded on Zoom in late July 2024. Welcome back to the podcast. It's been a little over 3 years since we chatted last time, but guess what? You are podcast number 100. So we've hit the 100 mark, and I wanted you back for the 100th podcast because so much has changed in the last 3+ years. Last time we spoke, everybody was talking about net zero 2050. Your company had come out with a net zero 2040 plan, and we had done a series of podcasts on net zero, and yours was the first in that series. But since then, the conversation has shifted to net zero 2035, and honestly, I'm delighted also to be able to chat with you today, because it means, at least for the next hour, I won't be talking only about the clean electricity regulations, which is all we seem to be talking about in Ottawa. So maybe just to start off, how much have things changed in the past 3.5 years?
Well, first, congratulations on your 100th podcast. I was hoping you didn't invite me because you thought that was reflective of my age. So it's, I think things have changed, as we're all aware, they've changed a lot, but not at all. And the reason for saying that, and this might have been true 3 years ago when I was on, is having a 50 or a 40 or a 35 aspiration to be net zero, which lots of companies put out different dates and round it to different spots, is all great.
Yeah.
But I think what we all knew at the time was this, in reality, this was a physical asset race to a goal or objective. And it was going to be hard. It was not going to be in a straight line. And the odds of getting to where many people thought we could get to by 30 or 35 were really, really low.
Mm-hmm.
And because it ultimately comes down to needing to do things in a physical system that are really hard and complex to do, especially when everyone else is doing them. So if Ontario was the only person doing it, only entity, easier. If right. Canada was the only country doing it, easy. But everyone, everywhere in the world, every neighboring jurisdiction has some type of goal and is electrifying things, which makes this highly complex because you can't rely on your neighbors to help you get there. This is going to be everybody lifting as opposed to one or two provinces or states lifting and everybody getting a lift off of that.
So part of the challenge is that everybody's fighting for the same piece of the same supply chains. Everybody's fighting for the same talent. Both of those, I expect, are big issues right now.
It is. I think you're right. I think when it comes to, you know, building out a workforce, being able to get materials, equipment, all the things you need to build out a power system, all of Europe's doing it. China's doing it. India's doing it, like everywhere in the world. So you go to real simple things like transformers, you're probably 3 to 5 year lead time. So if your planning hasn't started, and same thing on some of the projects we're doing around the nuclear space, if your planning isn't planning for 3 to 5 years from now, you will consistently miss by 3 to 5 years. And this is where I think this is not a political statement, but the political reality always gets caught up to by the physical thing that needs to be done. And, you know, I think from Canada, my view of Canada is that we have great goals and aspirations. There was zero chance of getting to 35 because the lift, even if Canada was the only one doing it, was going to be too big, let alone if everyone in the world is drawing on the same things as what we need in order to get there. Now that sounds very pessimistic. It isn't. Because the only way to get somewhere is to start. So I think many utilities, energy companies, and industry abroad all started, which is great. And that's what is needed. And then now the goal to me is to try to prevent as little being needed in those last 5, 6, 7 years as possible by accomplishing things now versus somehow thinking that we can do it in 2045.
Right. Right. So what is that looking like for OPG and your plans? As I noted, 3.5 years ago, we were talking about a recently published plan by OPG to be net zero by 2040. Is that still the plan for the company, or is, you know, the realities, the physical realities that you noted, have they changed? And presumably the demand curve has probably changed too, right?
Yeah. I think it's a bit of the latter. So our plan has not changed. So, so I think these are goals to try to achieve. And I'll give you, for Ontario, for example, my numbers would be slightly wrong, but, you know, if we're adding 750,000 people a year, if we're siting new car battery factories, you know, Stellantis, Volkswagen, a new car factories, electric arc furnaces at steel companies, I'd say the demand profile has consistently shifted up. Yeah. So I think as a company, what that might mean is we could still hit our goals. If we're still in the 1 or 2% load growth profiles, I think we will easily hit our goals. But I think the reality is that these are accelerating, and that is creating the positive dynamic that more things need to be done long-term oriented, but also probably a bit to the negative, more things need to be done short-term oriented. And what I mean by that is, and our Minister of Energy has come out and said this, gas is needed in the system. And it might be needed longer than anyone hoped for or thought because of the things I've just mentioned. And I think we're just seeing this across the world. The same dynamic. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. I just think it's a physical reality catching up to, or needing to catch up to, a very needed, required goal of achieving climate targets everywhere in the world.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when we spoke 3.5 years ago, we weren't talking about, you know, a million new Canadians each year, 750,000 new people in Ontario. That's got to really bend. That's a lot of people. That's got to really result in a significant bend to the curve compared to what we were thinking of, several years ago.
Yeah, it was. And like I say, the pace that an industry, depending on the province, whether it's, all the, everyone wants to talk about our data centers, but, a big car EV battery factory plant, these are huge loads that are being sited, not just in Ontario, but elsewhere. And I think these all then attract the need to do more faster. And as everyone probably listening to the podcast will know, building transmission faster is not easy. Building a nuclear plant faster is not easy. So a lot of what distribution systems, revamping a distribution system in Ottawa or Toronto or Regina or Vancouver, these are hard to do because people are living there while you're trying to do it. It's easy if it's a new subdivision, you got a nice field to put everything in, those are easy. Revamping Vancouver on the fly is really hard to do.
So, we touched a little bit on supply chain and that everybody's chasing very similar supply chains. As you're looking to the future, particularly with respect to your plans, the company's plans for small modular reactors. Does that play into it as well? In that, back in the 70s, we built this great ecosystem in Canada for CANDU. Is the plan here on SMRs to build more of a domestic supply chain so that we're not subject to the same degree to the challenges of global supply chains? Is that part of the plan?
So I'd say firstly on your first part of that, I think both SMRs and large reactors are required. So I don't think it's one or the other. I think some of them will be situational. So what can be built on a particular site, based on the characteristics of the site, how much load growth is in and around the site. So there's a variety of factors go to say which of the technologies do you build? And I think I see this across Europe. I see it in the US where it's the same thing, where in some specific locations they'll build large, other locations, SMRs make more sense. I think to your question on the supply chain, we have an amazing CANDU supply chain in Canada, which I think would support, both our refurbishments, and we've announced we're going to refurbish Pickering, which will be new since 3 years ago. But the refurbishments that Bruce Power has done, that we've done at Darlington, we'll do at Pickering, is because of the strength of that supply chain. Now, on your question on the SMRs, on GEH, which just happens to be the technology we've chosen, it is important to build out the ecosystem, important to have a lot of it. I would call it more in friendly countries with similar characteristics as Canada. So, and what I mean by that is you can look to the fuel supply for a lot of reactors around the world is 40 or 50% based on Russian fuel type. So I don't I think we're the US has passed a bill to say basically you have a certain target date, you have to be away from the Russian fuel. All good. And they'll rebuild the fuel cycle in the US or a Western European country. And I think this is the same on the newer nuclear technologies, is ensure the supply chain is in places that can be relied on for the life of a plant. Ideally, if you can get a lot of it into your Ontario or Canada, that's amazing. But realistically, some things like really heavy forging, there's only a couple of places in the world to do it. And for the most part, it's not Canada. So it's so but it's taking it to friendly countries that are similar to ours in their thought process.
So friendshoring, I think, is the term that folks often use. Okay. So on SMRs, small modular reactors, I have to note that one of the things that we were not talking about 3+ years ago was Alberta and partnerships there. I know that's something that you and OPG has been involved in, and you've got an agreement now to investigate this. Could you give the listener a bit of a sense of what that might look like?
Yeah, so I think Alberta as a province has been very public in stating that they want to explore the role of nuclear as part of their decarbonization energy transition process, and both from an electricity production standpoint, as well as there's been lots of talk by the oil sand companies as to does it play a role alongside carbon capture for the long-term sustainability of oil and gas production out of Alberta. So that's all very open, very public, and I think makes a lot of sense to do. And our arrangement with Capital Power, and Francis, I think you described it very correctly, is to explore how a nuclear facility for power production would make sense in the Alberta context. Now, it's a different market. It is an energy market, unlike a lot of the other provinces are utility or regulated based markets. And just to explore the feasibility, how you would do it, how stakeholders respond to it, all the things you'd want to look at that are different in Alberta than they are in Ontario, than they are anywhere, any of the other provinces. So we're excited by it because we think it's a great partner to work with, and a jurisdiction that is thinking we need to explore many options, this being one of them, if Alberta is going to achieve some of its goals for some of its energy transition issues that it faces and are unique. So we see this happening more and more around the world where jurisdictions that you wouldn't have thought would think about it are now saying we need to explore and understand it, as opposed to just saying, no, not applicable. We're finding the thinking process is now happening, and we're glad to be part of that with parties that think it's important for their business and have a level of commitment to explore it. And in the end, it'll make sense or not make sense based on a whole bunch of factors, all of which is like carbon capture, like hydrogen. You go through all the different sort of transition type of things that are being done, and some will make sense for some won't make sense for any for others. And that's why this is many technologies to get to everybody's climate goals. There's not a answer. It's not wind, it's not solar, it's not nuclear, it's not hydro, it's not carbon capture. It's some combination depending on your particular circumstance.
Well, and that's what we talked about when we chatted last time, was that the likelihood that the only way we'd be able to achieve our climate ambitions is just with an all of the above approach. But it does strike me that the conversation has shifted significantly, just specifically with respect to nuclear, where, 3 years ago, it was not certainly being spoken of and promoted to the same degree by the government of Canada here in Ottawa, as you noted with Alberta as one of the examples. But there are multiple jurisdictions that, several years ago we wouldn't have thought of that would be thinking that nuclear would be part of the future. What's your sense in terms of like how what shift took place to sort of change that conversation from one that was generally a more restrictive to one that seems to be far more open to this technology as we head to the future?
Physical reality. So it's, I think it's literally that simple. So I don't all of a sudden think people who didn't like nuclear love it. I think where the analytics of this took people to was there is not a different alternative in many scenarios. So if you say natural gas needs to be phased out, so it's no longer a fuel that you want to run your base power system off of, then you strike that off the list. If you're in a place like Ontario where wind profiles, now Ontario's maybe a bad example, but where if you're in a jurisdiction where wind profiles are poor, okay, it can do a little bit, not much. Further north you get, solar becomes less and less effective. And again, reliant on China for virtually all solar products, which ironically enough are made in coal-based regions. So I'm not sure there's any environmental benefit at all, but that's a personal view. So I think it just people started to say, politicians in many places started to say, okay, it's an alternative that fits to achieve a climate goal. So let's pursue it versus dismiss it. Now, once you get past that, increasingly we get three comments on nuclear that I think have always been there. You know, one is cost too much. Well, yeah, if you look at some of the nuclear builds elsewhere in the world, maybe they did. But if you look at some of the other ones, if you look more broadly, maybe they don't. You know, and Darlington and Bruce Power are good examples. The refurbishments are going great. They're going on time or ahead of schedule. They're going on budget or ahead of or under budget. So it can, any large infrastructure can be done well if you put your mind to it. So that's one. So the second one I got a lot from politicians was, but can I rely on it to be ready in time? You know, that still is to be determined. Can you do a brand new build of whether it's SMRs or large, doesn't matter.
Right.
And say it's going to be ready by 2000 and X and be ready. I think we have to prove that on our SMR project, that it is reliable time so that politicians can say, I can build that into my forecast, so to speak. And then the third is always around waste and or byproducts that come out of the nuclear electricity production process. And again, I think this has been something that the industry, nuclear industry, has done a really poor job of over the years. Is, you know, the Simpsons have defined what this looks like and how it is managed.
The Simpsons, the Simpsons, you mean the cartoon?
The TV show, yes. And but it is, this is something the industry is exceptionally good at around the world.
Right.
There's very little byproducts produced from the fission process. And I think we have told this in a highly technical way rather than a very common sense way. And increasingly, we see lots of people saying, you know what, this makes sense to us. And residents saying, yeah, you know what, this sounds like no big deal. And our First Nation partners begin to say, yes, you know what, this is nearly what we thought it was. So I think some of it is not greenwashing. It is explain it in a manner that someone can understand it.
Right.
And you might be shocked at how the result turns out different. And I see this across Europe now. This is happening and support is building from places that would never have supported it 5 years ago.
Right. Right. So you say it's physics. It's the physical reality. It's math. It's just simple math. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I'd like to circle back to the first of those three that you noted, and that was costs, because this is an area that I'm fascinated that for years and years there was only negative publicity about the cost and cost overruns of refurbishments, and now, you know, suddenly somehow Ontario has figured out how to do refurbishments, you know, on time and on budget. Why is it that we you know, for years thought that refurbishments simply can't be done on time and on budget, and you know, you and colleagues there have managed to do it and continue to do it now on new units.
Yeah, so I'll come back to OPG specifically and Bruce Power, but you'll. Let's be clear on big infrastructure. There's lots of them that are like Trans Mountain. How'd that pipeline go? Subway builds. There's lots of these infrastructure projects go way over budget.
Yeah.
And what we think, our view is that they all go over budget for one simple reason: poor planning. So you get in your mind that I need to do a ribbon cutting, an announcement of something on a day. And then be started and then start, not be ready, and then go over budget and then scramble to catch up for the next 10 years of whatever you're building, pipeline, transmission tower, nuclear plant. And this was pre my time. The team here broke that cycle. They simply would not start until they had the engineering predominantly done.
Right.
And tons of pressure to start early. And this is what happened at the earlier refurbishments at Pickering. I think someone woke up one morning and said, hey, let's refurbish reactor. Great idea. Let's shut it off and get going. It's the engineering wasn't done. Like all the basics that every book says you do first.
Right.
It's skipped. And in this case for Darlington, and Bruce Power's done exactly the same thing. We'll engineer when we're ready, we'll start. Because I saw a great example. I was over in Japan with one of the companies there, and they have this simplest chart. You know, at the planning stage, there is 10 people working on the project. At the engineering stage, there's 100 people working on the project. And at the construction stage, there's 1,000 people working on the project. Do not let the 1,000 on site until the 100 are done their job.
Right.
Wow. Then if you go a year long with 100 people, it's immaterial. You start to spin with 1,000 on site, it is impossible to catch up. And it's a discipline that I find is lacking on virtually all infrastructure projects.
Wow.
And there's great exceptions. I'm sure lots of companies and lots of others do amazing things. They do them on time. They do them within a budget. But too many start without the planning done. And I give the team, like say before me, a ton of credit for resisting the urge to start.
Okay. Oh, and let's talk a little bit about some technologies, because, you know, we've touched on some of them here. You know, the last time we chatted, we talked about, you know, the future is going to be in all of the above future. But of those, what are some of the ones that are likely to be important for Ontario, at least as you kind of plot out what the supply is going to be? Talked about carbon capture. Carbon capture is likely not going to be a significant piece of Ontario's future, is it? I mean, that seems to fit in other jurisdictions.
Correct. And that's why I say, if you go through all the various technologies, you go to Ontario and say, yeah, carbon capture, there's a little bit of room to do some stuff down on sort of the south side of the province, but not a lot. So yeah. you're not really going to count on it. Hydrogen is similar. Now, it's a bit more interesting in that, again, it's funny, as I go around the different places in the world, everyone is counting on hydrogen to be part of their energy transition.
Uh-huh.
Everyone is counting on being able to import it from somebody. No one's actually making it. Everyone's importing it. So, you know, that the other side of the demand supply curve needs to be fixed. So I think it's a really interesting fuel type. It's very unclear how you get volume of fuel to be impactful. Because again, taking, you know, one of the big projects is, I think, in Chile, converting to water to hydrogen, to ammonia, to ship, to back to hydrogen, highly inefficient, very, very expensive. So you only do that if it's a government program, which tend to be small and immaterial. So these different technologies, you know, fusion gets talked a lot about now versus fission.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe its day is on its way. People have waited a bit for it, like 50 years. But again, it's technology. Lots of money's going into it. So we'll see where that develops over the next decade or so. But I think if you look very near term for a province like Ontario, it's going to be more nuclear. It's probably going to be a little bit more natural gas to support the system.
Right.
It's going to build out as much hydro as left to build in the province. Put on some more solar, put on a bit more wind. You probably have to go more north to make the wind profiles make any sense. And then sort of go, you know, there's a lot of district heat. There's lots of these other things. You know, energy conservation is the best of all.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what my, this is just a personal view, that if you're paying 13 cents a kilowatt hour at home, you sort of aren't that incented. If you're in Europe and paying 45 cents,
mm-hmm.
You think about energy conservation all the time.
Yeah.
Because you're paying 45 cents. So yeah. I think some of these things are more useful tools than others, but it's going to be all of these together, and it'll be the weighting of them that will vary depending on the province, state, or country that you're living in.
Mm-hmm. With respect to hydrogen, because we did touch on it briefly when we last spoke, because I think at the time, hydrogen would show up in the long-term plan, you know, out to 2040, but it was just kind of, I think, just sort of sticking your toe in by the end of the planning time frame, just to see how it would fit. Is it still kind of on the horizon as something that may be part of your mix?
Yeah, it will be. So we have a couple of initiatives going, one down at the Niagara Complex. But I don't, they're not pilots. They're sort of small production facilities that we're working on.
Okay.
They're not, but they wouldn't be meaningful by themselves. And what we think needs to happen is the market needs to develop. So the price signal is there to build big.
Mm-hmm.
And we think it gets there. Maybe not in the next, you know, we've been maybe a little bit surprised how slowly, yeah, everyone talked about wanting green hydrogen and they really like it part of their decarbonization plan. But when anyone comes to really pay for it, no one wants to. Mm-hmm. So I think that part of the price signal and the dynamics need to evolve a little bit before we would say we would invest material dollars to pursue a major hydrogen initiative. But we want to be knowledgeable enough so we're ready to do that. We just haven't seen the price signals to cause us to do it yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, one of the other things that you'd mentioned earlier when we were talking about nuclear was First Nations and you know, they're part of that conversation. How do Indigenous communities and First Nations fit as partners when you're looking to the future of OPG? Because I know that's been a particular area and a personal area of interest of yours. So I'd be interested to kind of get a sense of how that's evolving and what is the future looking like?
Yeah, so I think the word you use is a really good one, partners. I think these are all long-term partnerships. Now, everyone tends to say, well, partnership, well, what percentage of partnership? It's I don't think it's how we should think about an Indigenous partnership. And I don't think it's how, I don't want to speak for our First Nations we deal with, but I don't think it's how they think about a partnership. A partnership in our conversations is increasingly around, yes, you know, what do I own? How, what percentage of that stuff? But it is around, okay, we want to build something somewhere. How do you engage the community, First Nations, but then also other communities, groups, in understanding why you're building it? What is the benefit to Ontario, the earth, et cetera, in building it? How can you build it the right way? Because everything you build negatively impacts the land, right? Because mm-hmm. you're digging a hole, you're changing water flows, you're, you know, impacting birds, et cetera. So it's how do you listen to our First Nation groups so we build things in the least impactful way? How do we ensure the people, First Nations, their communities benefit from jobs, benefits from starting up companies that might then develop core skills and go work off in any industry? They might mm-hmm. start with OPG and then go off and build great businesses working all over the place. And then how do you be a great partner, community partner over decades, and, you know, being involved in the community, being involved in education for the communities to these types of things. So the part, we've sort of morphed our view from what a partnership needs to look like, because increasingly the communities were saying, well, that's what they mean by a partnership. It's not a great, we're 50-50, let's go and build something.
Hmm.
So I think it's been a really, really good change that our team, our Indigenous relationship team, have led to say, let's make sure when we talk about partnerships, we're talking about that as the partner. So ultimately you get to a place where you're doing things out of trust with each other. Because I think by doing that, you get just a better relationship to do things that are in a positive way, that are impactful to the province, to the First Nations community, and to whatever other community, you know, Durham that we build in or wherever we build something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So last question before we get to talking about books, if you remember, we always finish up by talking about books, but the last question just about people. And, you know, we talked a little bit about people earlier on when we were chatting about the challenges, the physical challenges of getting things built and supply chains and people fall into that as well. How do you see the sector and kind of how we're doing, and if we could be better at making sure that we're appealing to the kind of talent that we're going to need to be able to meet these future challenges?
Yeah, do you know what? I think this has evolved really, really quickly. I think actually the energy transition concept mm-hmm. and companies that are actually trying to do things to advance against climate goals and objectives, now it is a competitive advantage in the hiring process. And I think everyone hears this about younger generations is that what is the purpose of what the company is trying to do? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is entirely in our favor now, because the purpose of what we're trying to do feels better now than it did 10 years ago. Right? Because we have the climate, the impacts of climate. People see, you know, whether it's natural disasters, it's more storms, bigger storms, more fires, bigger fires. And they're saying, I want to make a difference. So I think where 5 years ago, we might have lost someone to one of the tech companies because that was just cooler.
Yeah.
I think we see this tilting back towards energy companies because of the purpose of what we're setting out to do. Now, having said that, the onus is now on the industry and companies like OPG and others to make sure we are marketing that purpose. Mm-hmm. Because if the marketing is, I just want to build a nuclear plant, you want to come and build it? They're like, eh, you know what? That sounds very boring. If it is around, I want to achieve something on energy transition, I'm going to build a new nuclear plant, it's going to contribute to this and do this and achieve this amount of GHG reductions. We find young people now are pulled to this. And I'll give you an example. I was over in Italy at a polytechnical university. Now, Italy's going to announce they're going to restart their nuclear program mm-hmm. with a bunch of, I call them young kids because of how old I am, but a bunch of people that are in their master's of science, master's of engineering, and 100 of them who are taking a summer course on nuclear and how to join this part of the industry.
Right.
The professor said the runs it said it's now oversold, that they can't take all the kids in that want to join. Mm. So these are problems. And we see nuclear programs being restarted in Canadian universities and I think some of it is the purpose being important, but our industry needs to embrace this and market it differently so that we get the best and brightest that want to come into our industry and be part of what we are doing, because we can achieve great things. We can achieve all the climate goals that we need, and you know, can debate timetables, but we need amazing people that want to devote their brain power to it in order to do it, because some of the things that'll solve some of these problems no one's even thought of yet. But they will. And yeah, it'll getting these smart people here versus being a data scientist for Google.
Right. So if you're saying we need to embrace this, that would suggest that maybe up until now we've been a little bit tentative in terms of our embracing the critical role that we'll play in the energy transition.
Yeah, go back five years from ago and pull out job posting ads that the industry put out.
Ah.
Boring as all get out. And that includes ones that OPG did. So we need to inspire someone to want to be here.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, increasingly what we're doing. Yeah. And many other companies are doing as well. And we need to accelerate our effort there. So we are, like I say, getting the best of the best to solve the biggest problem the world faces.
Yeah.
In my view.
Cool. Okay. Well, Ken, the final question. You may remember this from the last time we had a chat. We've got our Flux Capacitor book club. We gather together book recommendations from all of the people that have been on the podcast. Here's your chance to put a second book on the reading list. I did read the first book you put on the reading list and thoroughly enjoyed the Midnight Library. If you have a chance to stick a second book onto this list, what book would it be?
So it's Peter Thiel's 0 to 1. Peter Thiel was one of the guys who started up PayPal and a lot of other tech companies along the way, highly successful. It's a relatively short book, so it takes probably a couple of fl or one flight or a couple of flights, depends how long you're flying or training, to read. And what he talks about is the importance of employee culture and the entrepreneurial spirit in solving complex problems. And it's a really, really good read around how to think around how do you get commitment by your organization to tackle problems that either you have no idea what the solution is, but you got to solve the problem. And goes into a lot of behavioral items as to how he thought about the companies he has led and been successful at, and people that he's been around and been successful at or been successful with, and the importance of certain approaches in your. So it's a bit more of a management book than the last one I recommended, which was a purely one to read to have fun. But I think it's a really good read. Someone recommended it to me, and I read it maybe 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, and it was really good. And I've already started to take some of it and say maybe there's a way to think about some things differently internally here. To achieve some of the things that are complex. And I think it's a really good book to read if you have a fairly established organization that you want to sort of say, wonder if I can affect change in a different way. And he has great examples. You know, he explains like why do people at tech companies wear t-shirts? It's so there's some really interesting things in there that are very counterintuitive to how some of us think. So I'd highly recommend it.
Fantastic. Okay, so we will add this to the reading list. It's 0 to 1 Notes on Startups or How to
Yes.
Build the Future
Correct. And
by Peter Thiel.
yeah, and it's as I said, it's you can be in a big company and it is a read you should do and learn from it. So it doesn't just mean if you're in a small tech company that's a book to read. It is equally as applicable in big companies. And how you take some of the principles and apply them.
Outstanding. That's a terrific addition. Really appreciate it. And Ken, appreciate you coming back onto the podcast and being number 100 as we hit that.
I'm honored. Like I say, it's not about my age, so that part's fine.
Terrific. Appreciate you taking the time.
Okay, Francis, enjoyed it a lot.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. I hope that what you've been able to glean from these conversations has been new insights and greater understanding of the complexity and challenges of ensuring that electricity continues to be delivered reliably and affordably to Canadian homes and businesses in this time of great change. Tune in for future episodes. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you listen. And let me know what you think of the flux capacitor. You can find me on our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website of this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 100. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Ken's recommendation, 0 to 1, Notes on Startups, or How to Build the Future by Peter Thiel with Blake Masters. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.